Hello, welcome to this episode of Communicable Research. My name's Andy Tattersall and I work at the School of Medicine and Population Health here at the University of Sheffield. Over this series of podcasts, we'll hear from researchers at Sheffield alongside some of their collaborators and hear about the work they undertake to tackle some of the world's biggest health challenges. If you want to know more about our work, then you can find us on the web at the University of Sheffield and on X at SHAR Sheffield. So please feel free to follow our updates there. And without further ado, let's get on with the latest episode. Hello and welcome to this latest episode. I'm joined by three experts in knowledge mobilisation. They're all currently funded by the National Institute for Health and Care Research as part of a three-year programme to move NIHR's research closer to local and national public health decision making. The project is called KnowPH and is a collaboration between the universities of Nottingham, Sheffield and Hallam. I'm here in a dual role, not only as the host and producer, but also I'm funded as part of this project and lead on the communication side representing the University of Sheffield. I'm going to start by asking my guests to say who they are, where they're from, and what their role is.
So Liz Such, I'm the University of Nottingham, the director of KnowPH, and look after the rapid response work.
I'm Fiona Marshall, research fellow based at the University of Nottingham, and I work full-time on the KnowPH.
I'm Joe Langley, I'm a design engineer based at Sheffield Hallam University, and I work on the deep co-production arm of KnowPH.
Okay, so to start, knowledge mobilisation, it's quite a broad term, so for those who are not entirely familiar as to what it means, particularly in this setting, can you give an overview to this actual project and what that means?
So knowledge mobilisation is related to the sort of similar terms around knowledge translation, knowledge exchange, etc. It's about how universities do research, produce evidence and knowledge, and then try to get that used by a specific audience. It's often previously, historically, been based on this kind of linear push. Let's put it out there. Let's tell people what the evidence says or what the knowledge is, and then they just expect people to use it. Knowledge mobilisation sort of realises that that's not quite how it works. It's not just about telling people what to do or what the evidence is and then just expecting them to use it. It's about being able to show them and then adjust it and accommodate it to their specific setting or needs or purposes. So in the realm of public health, that's really about working with communities and with local authorities to, because they're all different. People are different in all of these places. So how does this kind of particular bit of evidence, what does it mean to them and their communities and their needs, and how can we make it fit to their specific context?
Now, there's a lot of published research, whether that's formal reports, grey literature, peer-reviewed journals, which are growing exponentially. So a lot of that is a lot of wheat to sort out from the chaff. And potentially impactful research gets overlooked as a result. So how big a problem is that?
With regards knowledge mobilisation in public health, it's quite a large problem. We've found that whilst there are lots of peer-reviewed journal articles, they often fail to describe in depth the knowledge mobilisation aspects, and it gets defined in many different ways according to who the audience is. We have found that there are a lot of formal reports and grey literature which tends to provide more evidence of the activities used in knowledge mobilisation but does not actually evidence if it works. So this is one of the challenges of examining the literature and what's out there, is that very often these pieces of work do not evidence if they actually work immediately afterwards or longer term, and that's what really needs to happen.
Yeah, I also think that there's so much out there. So we're funded by NIHR, but there's so much information, so much evidence, and it's at our fingertips now. I suppose what we're trying to do is make that evidence like easy to access, you know, in the broadest sense of what access is. So it becomes like a default position for maybe local government or other people, other actors working in public health, to get close to it, to think, oh yeah, I need to maybe look and see what NIHR might have done around this topic. And if we get anywhere close to being able to do that, then that would be a success for us, I think.
I think another issue relating to this point is that the studies that are in the academic world perhaps celebrated the most and have the biggest noise, a are not necessarily the most impactful ones. So I think there's this kind of tension between what's celebrated in the academic world as big and good and impactful and what's really impactful in real world terms. And the two are not necessarily the same thing. So sifting through all of the kind of academic noise about what's good, bad, or sort of less well publicised or aware of or known, I think it's about going to what's relevant with the context. And that's a very different metric or measure compared to what academic work is usually judged by, which is often more about the sort of academic sense of rigour and validity, which is all about consistency and stuff like that. So there's a dissonance between those two things, and relevance and academic validity or rigour. And so I think that's a kind of really important point, that for knowledge mobilisation we have to differentiate between those two. And that can be finding the impactful studies that aren't having the big noise can be a bit of a challenge sometimes.
So we're specifically focusing on NIHR public health research. And what themes are you finding out and that are coming to the fore? And how have you come to a decision as to what areas of knowledge are best to mobilise?
So the main themes we found through exploring various databases provided by the NIHR in relation to public health were areas such as mental health, the environment, housing and air quality. And what we did with all these themes is that we presented them through a series of quick surveys and consultation with different members of local government and public health specialists, and asked them which of those themes they thought were most important. So right from the start, we've had a process of consultation because we feel that public health in local authorities know their local communities best, and they know what they can work with, and also they know what they need to know in these areas. So that's why, through that process, that's how they've been selected.
Now, this is quite a democratic and evidence process. And as you say, you're working with a variety of local authority staff to help shape the focus of this work. How important is it to have their input and views? Because this is quite sort of new in itself, isn't it? So how important is it to have that dialogue?
It's absolutely essential. It's core to the very, sort of goes to the very heart of what knowledge mobilisation is, in my view. So they are the ones that have a real sense of what's relevant and important and needed by their communities. They're closer to that front line of the communities and what those communities are experiencing in a kind of lived, felt, real experience. So they have that sense and understanding of what change is needed, what changes, where the changes are needed. And so getting a steer from them about their needs, problems and challenges, and then trying to contrast that with the evidence database to say, okay, there's something useful here that could help, is the kind of matching process. So for us, kind of sitting in the middle of all of that, it's about trying to find a match between what those people are saying in terms of their needs and wants and challenges and issues, what sits in the NIHR and other evidence databases and portfolios, and then what we can bring together in terms of us and our resources to help mobilise that, those people in the local authorities and communities and the evidence database. So it's a kind of triangulation of those three things. So without any one of those three, it kind of all falls down. It's like a three-legged stool. It needs all three legs to stay standing.
Local government and academia operate in their own certain ways, shall we say, have their own cultures and their own particular barriers to access and how they do things. So what are the barriers to working with those in local government, and how do we overcome them?
So you're right, Andy, to point out that the barriers come in both directions. So it's not just barriers for local government, it's barriers for us as people who work in totally different institutions. So bridging those divides in both directions, I think, is really important. So I was thinking, for me, working with local government, I see or perceive certain barriers. So things around time and resource. Everyone knows that local government is really stretched. So how do we engage in that context? Well, how do we set expectations of, you know, how people are going to respond to our queries and emails? And we've been trying to do that by focusing in on what people's needs are at a specific moment in time. So are they doing something which is public health relevant? Can we help the process that they're going through with something? Like we've just done something with Lincolnshire where they're refreshing a health and wellbeing strategy for their employees. So we can step in with some support, evidence support, and mobilise that evidence with them. So there's the time and resource issue, definitely is a big one. I think there's a kind of an unknown thing that we're yet to resolve, which is around the politics. So, you know, clearly evidence is just part of the decision-making process in local government. Decisions made, ultimate decisions made for local areas are made by politicians. So how do we engage with that process where evidence is part of what is a politicised process? And I think we'll gradually work our way around that. I'd love to do some work with councillors. So that's kind of ambition throughout the 3 years. At some point we can work with councillors just to see how evidence sits, how it is considered, negotiated in those politicised settings. I think that would be a real kind of bonus for us. When we're thinking about knowledge mobilisation methods, what's acceptable for certain audiences? So we're focusing on more creative methods, knowing that we want to tap into people's less academic ways of learning through experience, so using creative methods. And so, yeah, that was a really funny experience using the Lego, wasn't it, Fiona?
It was, and we started a session using Lego Serious Play with a simple introductory 5-minute task to build a duck from 6 bricks. Everybody had the identical bricks. We found that whilst some individuals really got into it and went with the flow of it, others were a little bit nervous about it and felt a bit unsure, to the extent that as professionals they felt that they were possibly being could be seen by their colleagues or others, so they tried to close the blinds in the room so they couldn't actually be seen playing. Yet we know that there's a lot of evidence that play really engages the brain and thinking in different ways, and that was our whole remit, was to explore different ways of thinking and considering aspects of these themes and the evidence.
It suggests that there's a bit of work to be done from us in terms of our methodological approach to kind of position a sort of authenticity to using creative methods and play methods to say that, you know, this isn't just about having fun or deliberately trying to, you know, like those rather crass icebreakers. It's not about making people feel uncomfortable for the sake of it. These methods play a really important role in trying to shift people's perspectives and enabling them to see things differently. And when you can see things differently, then new possibilities open up in how you can do things in response. So I think that's part of the challenge that we face, because this is quite a counter narrative to kind of traditional academic ways of working and working in local government. So coming back to the point about barriers for those working in local government, these are kind of very foreign, very alien approaches. And I think that we have kind of two jobs to do in a sense. One is mobilise the evidence in those contexts, and one is to kind of really convince people of the veracity of these methods and approaches.
For funders like the NHR, they can only do so much to ensure their research actually makes it into practice. They can do the work, but then there's a process needed after that. So how important is it to have something like this project? And I mean, it's good that the NHR have obviously backed it, but how important has this been?
I think it's probably a really important part of the future landscape. So again, thinking about resources, so local governments tight for resources, well, certainly the public sector in general and universities are all struggling for resource. So let's just make best use of what we've got. I think there's a lot of innovation bias, the sort of search for the new, when in fact we've got a lot over the years that we can use that still makes sense today and is, you know, robust evidence that will be usable over time. And that's one way of making savings, efficient choices. So yeah, it's important to NIHR. I think it's important to all research funders as we see the shift towards knowledge exchange, public engagement, all those things, super important.
I think there's an interesting question, because we're kind of like an experiment. We're the first of the kind that exists in this place. So, and not wanting to put too much pressure on ourselves, but it's kind of playing an important role in that future landscape Liz has just described. But I think there's something kind of interesting questions about whether us, teams like us in the future, sit as just kind of specific to a funder, or sit across a kind of portfolio of multiple funders, because there's a danger with some of this that, you know, prioritizing evidence just from one source over others. This is part of the problem that, you know, local authorities or knowledge users, and I'm using kind of inverted commas around that term, faces, that they're always kind of getting pushed these very, in one sense, quite narrow, very specific kinds of evidence, when what they need is a sort of multifaceted, broad and eclectic mix of different kinds of evidence. So there's kind of perhaps a thing that we need to consider as we go forward with our work and reflecting on what we do and how we do it, about sort of recommendations for teams and resources like ourselves to sit across a sort of wider portfolio of evidence producers, so that we can take more of a kind of sweet shop approach to kind of picking evidence from lots of different sources to bring together and amalgamate, because I think that's going to be something that might be more useful to the knowledge users, the context of use.
I agree. I think there's, for funders, the large funders like the NHR, I think there is signs of a shift in what counts as evidence. And I think that that needs to trickle down into the things that they will fund in the future. I think there is also a scope to urgently incorporate building the skills of knowledge mobilisation as an inherent part of funding a piece of work, because historically, not just the NIHR, but many funders, magnificent studies that hold enormous potential in public health have not been disseminated, have not been put out there, and it just sort of questions the value of what we as researchers are doing if we're not actually enabling public health workers and local communities to draw on this evidence.
That raises another point as well. You've just sparked something. So this is, I think the importance of this project is that perhaps it might evolve into a two-way thing. So rather than just taking kind of evidence and making it, putting it into context, it's about listening to those people and feeding back so that research priorities can be set. They can do research about things which are needed and relevant, because there is, I mean, it's what we've already found is that there is a bit of a gap. There are some things where they say we've got a problem here and a challenge, and there's evidence, relevant evidence in the portfolio, but there are other things where they, you know, they have an issue, and there's nothing there or nothing that can be used or is useful. So I think it needs to work in that kind of two-way flow.
I suppose, just as a point, it sounds very much like how the outside world works, that they do supply and demand, that you don't make things, put them on shelf that people don't buy. Mm. And we've got to think about that as research.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's a review that's carried out. I think it's in the American research ecosystem that looks at the sort of intellectual property within portfolios of universities and hospitals every 2 years. And I think it was around the 2010 report that came out. They found that there was a huge difference in the evidence or research that was put into practice between what they called a push and a pull. So where there was a evidence and research that was driven by a pull, a need or a problem, that was something like, I don't know, 70% more likely to actually make it into practice. Where you had evidence that was a push, so the academic saying, this is really interesting, let's do this, it was far less likely to actually make it into practice. And that's exactly that supply and demand. So when the research is responding to a really clearly defined unmet need, not an academically defined unmet need, but a user context, real world defined unmet need, it's more likely to make it into practice.
And that's increasingly needed in this day and age when we've got to justify and we've got limited budgets, etc. So absolutely, it's increasingly important. Yeah. In the case of this work, there's a rapid element to the knowledge mobilisation as well as a second arm of deeper co-production. So how do these differ in terms of the focused and the actual delivery?
Okay, so I mean, I can talk about the rapid element of knowledge mobilisation, which was, to be fair, reasonably new to me. The notion of rapid knowledge mobilisation when we were proposing co-production was a bit tricky in my mind, because how do you do co-production quickly? Everyone says co-production is slow and it's about building relationships and all that stuff takes time. So the rapid arm is, again, part of the experiment of NOPH. So the difference in terms of the focus and the delivery is that in order to make things rapid, choose a 3 to 6 month time period. So 6 months on a project is the very kind of end of a project. That's the hard deadline. But it can be shorter, and we've already done two projects, one with Health and Safety Executive and one with Lincolnshire County Council. The Health and Safety Executive had a very specific need, which we fulfilled by producing summaries of evidence, having face-to-face conversation, and they felt reassured that what they were advising in terms of health and safety and workplace stress were the right things, and that was a reasonably short process. But with Lincolnshire, it was much more involved, trying to establish what kind of need they had, but doing this in a quicker way. And I think councils are quite good once they're interested in getting back to you really quickly. Doing one face-to-face workshop, only using the NIHR evidence base, so rather than going to the outside, where there is a, you know, huge knowledge base, lots of evidence to bring together in the sweet shop that Joe referred to before, the sweet shop of evidence. There's a lot out there on the topic of workplace stress that we were working on, but we just focused on NIHR evidence and used that as a springboard to bringing in their own knowledge, to exploring other ideas and how they can develop their strategy in a meaningful, evidence-informed way. So do it quickly by establishing needs quite quickly, by limiting the evidence base to just NIHR evidence base, to building in interim knowledge mobilisation outputs and getting people to select and choose and prioritise. So really narrowing things down quickly and meaningfully. So that's the kind of rapid process. And the deeper co-production process, Joe?
Yeah, so I think with the deeper co-production process, it's far more orientated towards the local authorities and the community. So it's based on their needs more than being driven by the evidence. So the topics are identified and prioritised by them. We pull in evidence from a much wider portfolio. We'll centre the NIHR and the NIHR public health portfolio, but we're not restricted and constrained to that. And we have longer with them. So I think investing in that time in terms of building up relationships, investing in more creative ways to be able to express and communicate the relevant evidence and allow people the space and freedom to explore that evidence so they can really work out how it is relevant to them and how it can be adapted to their needs and their context, I think is an important part. But I think the time component is the biggest. So we've got between 12 and 18 months for these deeper co-production projects. So I guess as well, we're kind of working sort of further into the process. So it's kind of alongside them and with them, these local authority partners and community representatives from the relevant communities, in terms of not just considering what changes might be possible, but actually bringing them into a reality and putting them into some kind of place and context.
So we've talked about co-production. In terms of working with local government, who are you working with in collaboration and what does the co-production involve?
So for the deeper co-production projects, the sort of initial point of contact is with the public health experts or authorities or team members within local authority groups. But for example, the first topic that's been prioritised there is housing. So we would expect to be working with people from the departments of housing and planning and other departments that might be, you know, relevant to that specific topic. But it goes beyond the local authorities and local government as well. If there are third sector organisations or community groups that are really relevant to the specific nature of the problem within, I mean, housing is obviously a very, very, very broad topic. So whatever they kind of narrow their focus down to, working with community groups in their area that are experiencing this or the sharp end of this issue, we would bring them into the process as well, invite them into the process and make it sort of inclusive and as accessible as possible, and work with them whether they're kind of providing third sector services or community people that are kind of at the sharp end of the experience. So it's the relevant stakeholders as much as possible. And the advantage of that we have in terms of the deeper co-production is we have time to really reach out and explore and bring in more of those stakeholders, which I think is probably a point of difference with the rapid component.
Yeah, so with the first project on workplace stress, we've worked with people, like I say, at the Health and Safety Executive, who are responsible for guidance for businesses, essentially. But then in the local government, we worked with people not just from the public health team, but also people from human resources or people, I think was the name of the department. So the input was not just the public health perspective, but it was people actually delivering policies and guiding members of staff on how best to deal with workplace stress in their environment. So yeah, I think it's really important that the project does bring people in from outside of public health, because so many people that don't realise they have a public health impact in what they do can actually really change the environments within which people live, which has inevitable health and wellbeing outcomes for them. So it's really important we keep hold of the broad base in what we do.
And another collaborative element to this and another arm is the Public and Community Engagement Group hosted by AFRUCA, and they're a charity that protects the wellbeing of children and families in black and ethnic communities across the UK. How important is it to work with groups like AFRUCA?
Yeah, so AFRUCA are a really important organisation that I've worked with over the past few years, and it's been such an important learning process for me as a researcher, because AFRUCA is a black-led community organisation, operates in London and in Manchester. And from initially working with them, you very quickly begin to recognise how rare it is to hear the views and opinions of people with minoritised backgrounds in research. So working with AFRUCA was intentional for this project, in that we wanted to maximise what are seldom heard voices in how we approach community and public engagement involvement. It's a really intentional process and has proven really valuable so far and will continue to be undoubtedly. I think one of the important elements of working with AFRUCA is this reciprocal relationship we have between how AFRUCA and the community, the Public and Community Engagement Group, can support the work of NOPH, but also how NOPH can support capacity building within community organisations and black-led community organisations that are rarely involved in research or knowledge mobilisation projects like this. So it's been a great opportunity to embed that deeply in what we do, and there's definitely going to be mutual benefit, I feel.
We also asked the same question to Naeem Ahmed, based at AFRUCA, and find out how important it is for AFRUCA and those they support to have a voice in this work, as well as find out what do they gain from being part of the NOPH project.
My name is Naeem Ahmed, and I'm the lead for the Public and Community Engagement Group for the project. AFRUCA Safeguarding Children is a charity that promotes the well-being and protection of children and families in black and ethnic communities across the UK. Our involvement with the NOPH project is to lead and facilitate the Public and Community Engagement Group, which in short we refer to it as PACE Group. The communities we work with are often marginalized and disadvantaged. It is absolutely vital for such communities to have a voice in this significant project in mobilizing knowledge for public health. When AFRUCA is involved, we ensure that the unique challenges and perspectives of black and ethnic communities are heard. This means the public health strategies being developed will be culturally relevant and truly reflective of the needs of our people. In a nutshell, we are very much strong on representation and relevance. Another reason is addressing specific health inequalities. The NOPH project is all about reducing health inequalities, which often hits minority communities the hardest. By being part of this project, AFRUCA can highlight the specific health issues and systematic barriers our communities face, leading to more targeted and impactful solutions. Lastly, empowerment and inclusion. Having a voice in this project means AFRUCA and those we support can actively participate in the decisions that affect our health and well-being. This inclusion not only empowers us, but also fosters trust and a sense of ownership of the public health initiatives being rolled out. For us, being part of the NOPH project offers a range of valuable benefits. One, and access to evidence-based strategies. We can use the evidence gathered to enhance our own programs and interventions. This high-quality evidence-based information will make our efforts to tackle public health issues in our communities more effective. There is also the opportunity of networking and collaboration. So joining the project allows us to collaborate with other stakeholders, including local authorities, health agencies, and public health experts. These connections can lead to new projects, partnerships, resources, and support for our initiatives, expanding our reach and impact. And lastly, capacity building. Our involvement in the NOPH project helps build our capacity as a charity by enhancing our knowledge, skills and tools for implementing comprehensive public health approaches. This growth strengthens Africa's overall impact and sustainability, ensuring we can continue to support our communities effectively.
Now, what's being done to ensure that this work is truly co-productive and not tokenistic? Because it quite often it's a box-ticking exercise or it's a one-way dialogue. So what's being done to ensure that that isn't the case?
I think there's a number of different things, and it's not there is one specific answer or one kind of silver bullet to this. It's a sort of pervasive approach into everything that's done. And I think this is one of the things that can help us distinguish between pieces of work that are more tokenistic and those that are less so. So it's a kind of cultural thing. If people really believe in the value of what someone has to say in a minoritized or undersupported voice or sort of amplifying hidden narratives and counter narratives, I think that it goes beyond just kind of giving someone 5 minutes to say their piece and recording that on a Zoom call and transcribing it into a form of text. It's about listening in a way that involves your sort of whole emotional being, so that you take on board what they're saying and adjust and reflect. So there's a bit of reflective practice in that as well. So I think there are kind of a number of sort of, I guess, bureaucratic indicators. So having someone who might be a co-investigator on the study who kind of comes from that group or those groups, having sort of specific governance things and bodies of panels of people like our PACE group. For sure, these are all kind of really important features. But how we kind of put what they say in a meaningful way into what we do as a group, I think that's more the measure of how things can be truly co-productive or tokenistic. So a big part of our response to that is transparency. So we're trying to have a kind of living documentation that's public and open, and that would include the things that are said in the PACE group, and then it'll be a sort of identifiable about how that has informed and directed what we do and how we do it. And the same with the rapid and deep co-production projects, where those voices are involved and included in those activities and pieces of work. Being able to point and direct through this kind of open, transparent documentation of work where it has had an influence and changed the direction of the dialogue. These are the kind of points that will kind of be amplified and highlighted to illustrate exactly. And if you can't point to that within your documentation, if it's just about these people sit on a group or a panel, I'd suggest it's really sort of more in the tokenistic lines.
We also asked the question to Naima as to what's being done to ensure that this work is truly co-productive and not tokenistic.
Truly, we're very keen about this. And I think for most research, we keep hearing co-production. And when you really delve into it, you only realize that it's a tick box approach. So to ensure that the NOPH project is truly collaborative and not just tokenistic, we have several key strategies which we've already put in place, especially from a public and community engagement perspective. One, inclusive partner selection. We are involving a diverse range of partners right from the start, including public health specialists, people with lived experience, and community leaders. We've drawn members from the BASNET, that's the UK BME Anti-Slavery Network, full members. We've also drawn service users from Africa. In fact, with the PACE group, we have, for the first time, we have a very young person sitting on the PACE group to be able to bring a perspective of the younger people when it comes to public health. So this ensures a broad spectrum of voices and perspectives, which are very much needed. We are committed to equality, diversity, and inclusion, and our PACE group, made up of ethnic minority individuals, has been providing significant and often overlooked perspectives. Secondly, collaborative sense-making. We are hosting interactive workshops and sense-making exercises with our partners to co-develop plans and outputs. This hands-on collaborative approach ensures that the evidence is interpreted and applied in ways that are meaningful and useful to everyone involved. Lastly, we consider feedback very, very significant. So we are looking at iterative feedback and adaptation. The project plan to include regular feedback sessions and adaptation of our outputs based on partner input. From a PACE perspective, whenever we have sessions and meetings, we also follow up to have one-on-one conversations with group members to hear their views, what they are saying, what they think in a broader perspective, especially if the time is very limited. And this ongoing process allows us to continuously improve and respond to the needs and suggestions of all participants, ensuring everyone feels heard and valued. So just to conclude, based on the questions answered, implementing these strategies, the NoPH project aims to create a genuinely co-productive environment where all partners, including Afruka, can actively contribute and benefit from the work being done.
So now, public and patient involvement, like many progressive activities in academia, are not formally rewarded as they're not regarded as things that support career progression. Now, surely that's got to be addressed to reflect the changing environment and also to encourage more people to do this form of progressive work.
I agree. I think that public and patient involvement, particularly in applied health research and public health research, has to be at the core of all future research. One of the key issues with that is that currently in the measures of impact, patient and public involvement is not particularly high up there, and so this embeds a culture whereby it can very easily become tokenistic and it can become something that is just done but on a very superficial way. The risks of that are that we're basically developing researchers who see this as not absolutely necessary for their career progression. I would argue that as things are shifting, it will become more essential for their career progression. And I think that funders will certainly be more critical of the areas in which they have actually shown and demonstrated sustainable activities and engagement with public and patients. I think one of the difficulties is that it can become very difficult to sustain engagement beyond the end of a funded project. And I think that there needs to be some serious mechanisms put in place to enable that, so that those people who kindly give their time and their input do not feel that they've just been left after a piece of work finishes, because it just builds up resentment and less engagement in the future.
Yeah, I think this career progression thing is closely related to a wider sort of academic ecosystem and culture. So where this is, if this were properly valued within the entire academic ecosystem, then those issues that Fiona has just referred to around, you know, supporting and funding this investment from public and patients in this work would be more systemically embedded. There would be mechanisms for doing exactly what Fiona has described, whether it's supporting the activity of preparing and developing bids and writing bids, having roles that are sort of more formally entrenched within the academic job role profile portfolio, so that someone, a public member, can have a job and a contract more easily and be remunerated in whatever way flexibly suits them and their needs. And then after a piece of work has been completed, can have a kind of role that, or some kind of mechanism for recognising them and their investment in different ways. And then if that was kind of in place, then it would feel that the kind of recognition within career progression would follow more naturally. So I think this is, whilst it is relevant to career progression specifically, I think there is this wider kind of cultural thing within academia that needs to be addressed. And that comes down to the way that different forms of knowledge are valued, different forms of investment within those sort of research and innovation processes and activities that we do.
So what do you think is the way forward? Is it the carrot and stick approach here, or what would be, in my head, a carrot baton? That you have a formal process that recognises what you're doing, but also there's the carrot that shows that this is a different way of working. It's quite an engaging way to work. It's quite a fulfilling way to work, and it's actually making some sort of progress where we haven't done before.
I think that's a really interesting question, because there's some evidence to show that when PPI and sort of public involvement in research first started way back, it was a sort of grassroots level thing. And so the people that were doing it were doing it authentically. They were really engaged and they believed in it. So we knew that what was going on was, you know, there might have been kind of variations and differences, but it was coming from the right place, the right intention. As it became more mainstream, it went to a kind of top-down thing where it became almost mandated and required by funders. So it moved then to more of a tick-box exercise. So more people were doing it because they had to rather than because they believed in it. So the stick kind of approach there has had pluses and minuses. It's had this thing of making it more mainstream, of making it and bringing it more into the consciousness and whatever, but it's also had this kind of other side effect of encouraging people to do it because they have to rather than because they believe in it or they want to. So I think for the first thing, I think in response to that question, stick alone, not good enough, it won't work. There has to be a kind of carrot thing. There has to be something that recognises and not rewards in a kind of just because you've ticked the boxes way, but rewards and recognises. And that, I think, will come, like a lot of co-design, co-production, sort of the social model of knowledge development and use. It's hard to evaluate the impact of these things because each one is different. So the evidence to show that this is a good way of doing things, that this achieves impact, is slow to emerge and evolve. It's hard to get that evaluative data and evidence. But as time progresses, I think these stories and examples of where this has worked and how well and the kind of level of change and whether it's kind of second order, first order, second order innovation or impact, whatever it is, this will begin to accumulate a body of kind of case studies and impacts examples that will begin to tell its own story and its own narrative about how beneficial this is. And I think that's the kind of carrot that we need to work to. And it takes persistence. It will just take a kind of dedicated hard work to reach that kind of end point. But once we get to that, it will be kind of telling its own story, in a sense. We won't need to do that. That's my view anyway.
Now, we live in a time where there's several competing local and national priorities, and they're very changeable. And it's obviously been exacerbated by various factors such as the pandemic, cost of living crisis, and the ever-changing political climate of which we're going through one at the moment. How important is it to be agile when mobilising knowledge? I mean, what are the challenges to that approach, and how do we overcome them? And there will be other threats and other spanners thrown into the works, probably in the next two or so years. How important is the agility?
I think we need to kind of be a little bit careful when we're using that term agile, because in some contexts, that's kind of associated with very specific kind of methods. So in kind of digital innovation spaces, the kind of agile scrum techniques have a very, very specific kind of connotation. And I mean, that might be more aligned to the strand of rapid co-production work that is going on within NoPH. And I think Liz might be better able to respond to that part of it. And it kind of reflects a piece of work that Liz led that was at UK Knowledge Mobilisation Forum around, you know, how fast can co-production go. But there's also agile in the sense of being flexible. And I think in knowledge mobilisation practices and processes, that idea of flexibility is really, really super important. Opportunities arise that might be unanticipated. And to be able to be effective at knowledge mobilisation, it's really important to react and respond to those and take them up and take advantage of them. And within the kind of research funding landscape, that's something which perhaps funders are not so accommodating for. They like really prescribed processes. They like to know what they're funding in advance. It de-risks it for them. I mean, it's understandable. They're using public money to invest in, so they've got to have a bit of confidence in what they're going to be putting their money into. But having some leeway in this within funded pieces of work, I think, is really super important. And that may be something where, you know, hopefully we can see a shift within funders and what they're prepared to, and kind of pathways to dissemination that is a big part of what people have to describe, might have some scope for more flexibility and more opportunism. But I think Liz might be able to kind of pick up on the other point about agile in terms of speed of co-production.
Yeah, I mean, I subscribe more to your definition of agility there, really, Joe. You know, the thinking on your feet, the being flexible, the responsiveness to the need that's being expressed, and that changes, can change quite suddenly at a given moment. And windows of opportunity is something that I've always gone on about for knowledge mobilisation. So, and it relates to the point you made earlier about the push and the pull. So if there's a distinct desire, if there's a movement, a shift in sounds, then that's a perfect open door for knowledge mobilisation. So going into conversations with evidence at hand or themes at hand that you can draw from the evidence base are really helpful and encourages conversations and decisions to be made in a way that is evidence informed. So it's kind of recognising, which can be difficult, the open doors for knowledge mobilisation, rather than constantly sort of seeking for your, for this, you know, amazingly robust randomised controlled trial finding that shows a really tiny effect, but you're, you know, you've conducted this amazing study in this methodologically robust way, but has potentially very little real world impact, or it's not the right time for it to make that impact. Is sort of knowing when to step up to, you know, and scan the horizon, see what opportunities there are for mobilising evidence at that point in time. It's very time dependent. I think that is kind of the agility skill in knowledge mobilisation that is also a luxury that many researchers are not afforded.
Just picking up on that point, I think perhaps that's even more sort of amplified within the public health space, because I think there's the kind of responding to those opportunities within the messy world of practice, which is relevant to public health and many other sectors. But public health is also picking up on the sort of political cycles and influences, and that's more like a, rather than sort of messy in a practice-based context, it's more like a cat on a hot tin roof, kind of chopping and changing really rapidly in terms of what policy priorities are, that can be, you know, sometimes driven just by public opinion and tabloid papers and headlines like that, as politicians flip-flop. Those two points of sort of rapidly shifting sands, I think was the term that Liz used, that come together in the domain of public health, which means that opportunities, you've got to fit in with political opportunities, funding opportunities, practice opportunities, all sorts of kind of different opportunities that will fluctuate and kind of move and shift at different tempos to each other. So those kind of windows of opportunity, you have to be good at spotting them and then be able to move rapidly to take advantage of them.
And Joe, you touched on dissemination, and Liz, you said the word luxury. And dissemination is often a luxury. Most research projects don't factor in any notable communications or dissemination, if at all. And when they do, invariably it's a bolt-on at the end. It's something that's happened afterwards. But in the case of this NOPH work, the plan is to be wholly open throughout. How important is that, especially given that this really is groundbreaking area here, that we're in uncharted territory?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously super important, and I just want to point out that I'm not a communications or a dissemination specialist. So the kind of assumption is that if you're involved in knowledge mobilisation, you come with these extraordinary science communication skills that have been learnt through a background in comms like yourself or journalism, and that really isn't the case. There's the main body of knowledge mobilisation specialists come from like a domain expertise, so mine being social policy and public health, and you have to acquire them and learn them, and that's quite interesting because you have to, and it's helpful because you know the context. And so the idea of kind of bolting on is assuming that we can do it, that we have the pre-existing skills there, but they're not there for many people. And I don't know about anybody else, but I certainly didn't have any comms and dissemination training throughout my academic career. So it's all been self-learn or self-directed, and helpfully through, you know, some funding to support that. So I think there's a bit of a gap between what's expected by funders and possibly by people with whom you're supposed to be mobilising knowledge, so policymakers, practitioners, that you know how best to do this stuff, and that's a false assumption. So we need to kind of break that down and really invest in the skills and confidence of people that are with research backgrounds, or maybe just develop a whole new cadre of professional who is like the knowledge mobiliser, the knowledge technician, the communications and disseminations manager, for, you know, trying to think of a good way to term it, but I've not found one yet. But it's so not a bolt-on. It really is a specialist range of skills that I find even now, as, you know, leading this program with you as colleagues, that I'm learning on the job. It's not something that I've been able to access throughout my career, put it that way. So it's super important, shouldn't be assumed, and not a bolt-on.
I think also building on what Liz has just said, I think it is important in a way that we aren't communication specialists, that we're not the glossy professionals working with teams of public health groups and others. I think that it's probably quite heartening for them to realise that we are, you know, wading our way through this, using the evidence, and that we're learning as much from them as they are from us in this. Part of the process of NoPH is so that we learn and reflect on our own practices, and in doing so we can build and build on this, but also we can hopefully learn and reflect and from those who we disseminate to. So it's very much a process of all the way through the next 3 years.
Fiona's just kind of really echoed the point that was in the back of my mind as Liz was speaking. So I'm not sure, I mean, that might be the first time you've ever been referred to as a glossy professional, Andy, but there's, I think this is the first project or programme that I've worked on where the communications have been embedded in it in the way that they have, and to have the expertise that you bring. I mean, it's an expertise that I would never hope to be able to attain within my kind of working lifespan. It's professionalism. It's what your kind of background is, and that's a kind of set of skills which is incredibly rare in the sort of academic landscape. And I don't think we can stress this enough, because there's a technical aspect to it as well as so there's a competency about how you do things, which has made our work in doing this so much easier. But I think the point that Fiona made, which I really wanted to pick up on, was the benefit that I've experienced in doing this. It's a different form of communication that I benefit from. It's the reflective part of it. It's more conversational, it's more dialogical. It gives me that opportunity to have these sort of, rather than this dissemination tends, I mean, I know you can do blogs and less formal forms of communication with dissemination models, but it is, in academia, it tends to be more formally structured forms of communicating the work that has been done. These kind of methods that you use and you've brought into our kind of library of stuff that we're using within OPH are far more kind of informal and conversational and accessible and so on. And I feel the benefit of that. It's not just the kind of pushing stuff out. I'm thinking differently about what we're doing. I'm expressing that differently, and that's making me think differently. And I'm learning from doing this. And I think that can't be undervalued. And embedding it from the very start of this program throughout, I think has been, I've definitely felt a huge, my ideas are shifting as we go through these processes because of the strategies and methods and approaches that you have brought to this.
I would just add that I'm also learning. I'm learning from you guys about what knowledge mobilisation is, and that's helping me as well and help me understand. So this is really a very, very much a reciprocal agreement going on. It's a mutual, absolutely, and I'll take being called a glossy professional compared to some of the things I've been referred to in the past. But talking about the actual creative element and the dissemination side of it, Marshall McLuhan coined the phrase, the medium is a message, and it's quite important to this work. It's something that I subscribe to, that it's how you're doing things can be as important as to what you're trying to say. And we're working with creative partners to help disseminate knowledge, because there's a lot of things that we can't do. And so do you want to explain to listeners who we're working with and the kind of outputs that we hope to produce?
Sure. So we've got budget within this program for engaging with a range of creative partners. We've specified three specific ones, but we're not just limited to them. The three that we've got: Cardboard Citizens, who use forum theatre and performative methods. We have Optical Jukebox, who do documentary filmmaking and interactive documentary filmmaking. And we have Nifty Fox, who do sort of illustrations and infographics and live drawing and a number of other things, which are based in sort of 2D, two-dimensional image sketching illustration sort of formats. And there are a number of other sort of mediums that we could use. I think the important thing with these different mediums is that words, whether written or spoken, are not necessarily the optimal way of communicating anything, nor are they the optimal way with which many people can take information in. I mean, there's a huge body of evidence around sort of different sort of learning styles and preferences from sort of educational literature. And academia, unfortunately, tends to sort of really focus on written and perhaps spoken word. Conveying some of the really complex concepts and understanding of evidence in these formats can be very restrictive for a number of different communities. I mean, let's take, for example, a community of people that for whom written communication might be very limited. Their entire culture might be based on oral traditions and oral histories and oral communication. So anything that comes in a written format is immediately going to be exclusive. So using things like, I'm making some assumptions here, we haven't tested this or sort of evaluated it in any way, but performative methods might be more beneficial in those kind of contexts in terms of communicating evidence. In other formats where you might have, for example, people who may be blind, you might, you know, video media alone might be completely pointless. So it's the medium is the message. It's the appropriate, culturally appropriate, accessible in terms of people's physical abilities and cognitive abilities. All of these things play a role. And again, going back to the point we made earlier, it's not about telling people what the evidence is, but showing them in a way that they can interact with and make sense of. And again, that kind of degree of interaction is important within these creative methods as well. So going back to kind of Cardboard Citizens and Forum Theatre, that's an interactive performative method and approach which allows people to engage with the narrative that's being communicated, and I think importantly is allows them to engage with the narrative and speculate about how it could be changed to make achieve different outcomes. I think that's kind of like a theme or a component, is these creative methods making them interactive and engaging, and that's a lot easier when you're using Lego or performance for people out there in the public and rather than an academic paper. That's far less interactive. That's far less accessible in those sorts of formats. So this is, I mean, there's not a lot of evidence out there about the effectiveness of these approaches, and that's part of what we're exploring with this programme.
Joe, you've talked about accessibility, and this is something that you've talked about, Fiona, about making what we do accessible. And it's something that we don't particularly do very well, and we're only just starting to do it in terms of learning and teaching, making teaching materials accessible. So not only how important is this, what can be done to actually make it that we actually do this again as part of the process naturally, that when we're making these outputs we make them accessible?
I think with regards to accessibility, it's quite a complex area, and I think that in many ways it has been the preserve of dedicated consultancies and experts, and to some extent it remains in that. I think, though, the current way in which digitalisation and easier tools are available, I think most people can enable and provide materials that are more accessible. So that can be as simple as embedding by default that all documents are sent in Microsoft Word and as a PDF, which means that a person who's using a screen reader can choose the most appropriate format for them. I'm very keen that all websites and links to different parts of organisations within websites are easy to do, and that these websites can be adapted readily into large prints, into different fonts, etc., just by default. It's very easy to run with things having to look wizzo and look very artistic and wonderful, and of course they do to the majority of people, but sometimes things as simple as black backgrounds on websites are horrendous for people with visual difficulties, impairments, and also for others who, you know, simply cannot see the text against that black background. And I think that as part of universities across the board, we're pretty poor at it, to be honest. And I think that there's still a lot to be learnt about that. And I would just like to see it embedded as a default, as simple as that.
So again, this is going to be another thing as part of our learning process. Yes.
We're going to make mistakes on it. We're not going to achieve all of it, but we are going to try our best to do this.
Yeah, and as part of the openness, we can share what we've done and what we've found, can't we, as part of that. And storytelling and Lego Serious Play something that I know you know a lot about, Fiona, increasingly being used to help mobilise knowledge. How do you convince those who might dismiss these as novelty that they don't actually make an impact?
One of the, as we've touched on earlier, one of the aspects of our work is that it is evidence-based, and the methods and approaches that we use, we draw on evidence. So we'll draw on that from things like adult learning, how the brain engages with new information, which is all out there and very, very robustly established. And we know that as adults, we don't actually lose the ability to play. We still learn through play. It's just that culturally, we tend to have that bashed out of us. And certainly, by the time we reach 18, we're probably not playing as much as we should be. But we know that through playing and creative methods and approaches that we learn far more, we absorb far more, it's retained for longer, and also it's almost embedded in your memory, and it enables storytelling as well to take place, so that, you know, a person who plays and learns from playing with new evidence actually can also go on to explain what they've learned to somebody else. And we always use evidence-based approaches. I think what we've learned so far is that we need to be more explicit in how these can be of value, particularly amongst professionals who may feel that it's not for them, that, you know, their days of playing, etc., are over. And I think that we're going to have to look at some of the ways in which we communicate that effectively. But I would say that in some ways, rather than getting hung up on that, what we need to do is actually give people permission to just do hands-on and get going with it. So, you know, they don't have to be good at art. They can just draw little stick people, and that's absolutely fine. They don't have to be good at building magnificent Lego models. They can just use their hands and let their hands direct them.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really interesting research going on at John Hopkins University that's looking at, I think they describe it as neuroarts and neuroaesthetics, which is looking at the connection between how our brains respond to doing creative things and engaging with creative products and outputs. And they, I mean, their work shows that when you do these things, you make new social connections and neural connections, new connections in your brain. So when we are doing these things with people, whether it's Lego and sort of play-orientated creativity or sort of more arts-based orientated creativity, it's about making these new connections, social connections or neural connections. It's about being able, that those new connections help us to see things in new ways and see new possibilities and new insights, new ideas. And, you know, storytelling, it's the oldest form of knowledge mobilization that exists, isn't it? We've always been telling stories throughout human history. I mean, there's stories, whether, you know, we can argue about the veracity of the evidence embedded in them, but nursery rhymes were, you know, the oldest form of telling someone what to do within the plague or, you know, the Black Death or whatever it was. And there's a modern example or equivalent that is evidence-based. There's a great study that's called Life-Saving Lullabies, which took evidence about maternal and newborn infant health and embedded it within a series of lullabies as a way of communicating and passing on that knowledge at low cost. I mean, there's no monetary cost to that as a form of spreading and sharing that evidence. So it's incredibly effective and powerful, and that those kinds of things can be adapted to sort of cultural relevance. So you can adapt the meter of the lullaby or the words and lyrics within it to a certain degree. It can be sort of customized to different contexts. So those kind of forms of communicating are kind of, the potential impact of them is massive. And, you know, the variety, whilst some of them might seem more expensive than others, there are sort of a range of different options for different forms of evidence. And again, this is one of the big things that we don't yet know is, you know, when is Lego more effective than forum theatre? When a lullaby is more effective than rap? I have no idea. Let's explore them. Let's find out, rather than sort of putting barriers up to try in one form or the other.
It always makes me think of that old saying as well, which I live by, that we don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing.
Yeah.
And I think that this form of research, if anything, the form of work we're doing is going to keep us all youthful. So finally, the work's aiming to lead from the front in an evolving research environment, and for that it needs to create a legacy and a new way of mobilising knowledge. So where do you see this work leading, and how will we know whether we've done a good job?
I think initial markers of success or thing when I know I've done a good job is when we'll be able to go to whichever local authority and say that we're knowledge mobilisation specialists or we're supporting evidence in the decision making, and they'll go, I know what knowledge mobilisation is, and come in and help us with our decision making. So that's an early sign. That would be an early sign to me that things were going well. I think that's part of the whole infrastructure of evidence, how we commission it, how it's used, that, you know, that's such an important element that's often been left to one side for someone else to do. So that would be a great mark of success. I think ultimately this is a public health grant. This is, you know, to support public health, reduce inequalities. And if we can draw plausible lines between what happens with us and what happens in terms of outcomes for people in places that have been maybe left behind or traditionally underserved, if we can draw a line between our starting point and the finishing point, which are hopefully improved outcomes, then that is a huge, huge success. And that's a long way down the path. And it needs more investment. It's not just us alone, it's other people. So seeing knowledge mobilisation in other people's grants as a routine part, mainstreaming knowledge mobilisation as part of the research process, which it always has been in the tidy diagrams that we see of how knowledge mobilisation or the research process works, actually living that in other places, not just us, that would be a sign of success.
Years and years ago, Dan Wolstenholme and myself did this co-design Better Burst by Design project funded by the Royal Mid Council of, what is it, Royal Midwifery? I can't remember the professional body. And we worked with Preston Midwifery Unit. And occasionally, 10 years later, they still tweet. They say, just doing this thing, remembering Joe Langley and Dan Wolstenholme. And at that, I think if we were able to be name-checked by a local authority using some kind of creative method in a few years' time, that's where I go, yeah, we've kind of done something there. So at that kind of grassroots level. But I think there's also, I would be really, really kind of interested if there was some kind of changes within the academic culture. Because in a sense, I almost think that's the most intransigent part of this system. If we can kind of see some dent or echo of something filtering through to other academics and maybe through the funding system, I would say that would be the far bigger kind of achievement in one sense, because I think that's the really tough egg to crack. That's the bit that seems to me the least, for all the factors about innovation, the culture itself seems less open to change than other cultures out there and less flexible. I think that might not be a welcome message that people in the academic environment want to hear, but, and it is just an opinion, but for me that would be the biggest indicator.
I think for me, building on what Joe's just said, it would be the dissolution of academia and the culture as it stands at the moment, because in the real world, we're all individuals, we all wear different hats, and what I've found stark in academia is that we're assumed to all be academics and the same. And I think that if higher education and research are to prosper, we need to have far more diverse academics and people involved in research and acknowledge all those different hats that we do wear, because at the moment it's quite divisive between, you know, we talk about PPI as if they're wearing some elusive hat and bringing some elusive experience, and of course they're really valuable, but at the end of the day we're all people. And, you know, we have academics that are also members on PPI groups for other pieces of research, etc. And I just think that, yeah, that's the way forward for me.
The revolution starts here.
Yeah.
It won't be televised, it'll be podcasted.
So hopefully this is the start of the beginning, and in a couple of years' time, this legacy will continue and hopefully expand and become more normalised. So let's see where this takes us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to hear new and previous episodes as part of this series on various podcast platforms, including Spotify, Apple, and the University of Sheffield Player. If you want to know more about the research and teaching we do at the university, you can find us on the web and on X. We also run master's courses in addition to expert-led short courses, which again you can find on our website if you go to www.shef.ac.uk.